ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
We've always been very bad at predicting the future. Don't believe me? Well, 67 years ago, the ABC asked Australians to do just that, and...
You all commute daily and hourly so fast through space in your private flying saucers...
Global peace and international harmony will be completely attained by the year 2000.
Yeah, still waiting on that world peace. I'm Matt Bevan, and from If You're Listening, this is Black Swans, a series about the events we can't see coming, no matter how hard we try. It's available now on ABC Listen.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
Government is always formed in the sense of the centre, but our Liberal Party reflects a range of views.
Politics is the brutal game of arithmetic, but no one's going to vote for you if you don't stand for something.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvallis, joining you from Wurundjeri Country in Melbourne.
And I'm Fran Kelly on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation here in Sydney.
And Fran, it's summer! Although sometimes in Melbourne you'd question whether it's true. I've just had some Sydney friends visit saying, God, is this really a thing? Anyway, but it is summer. It's the most wonderful time of the year if you're into summer. Some people hate it, but I think it's a great time of the year. Are you a summer person, Fran?
Oh, I am so into summer. Luckily for me, I live quite near the beach, not on the beach, but quite near the beach. So I will go to the beach every single day. I will have family members up this summer. We will take them and little kids to the beach. I just can't get enough of it. I have recently had a knee operation that's put a little bit of a fly in the ointment, but, you know, I just love it. I'm going to the beach with family for a week or something, and I just cannot wait because I'm just in the beach, in the water, all day. Love it.
Yeah, I'm very much the same. I do love summer. I notice my moods improve. I have seasonal depression has become the kind of cool thing to admit now over winter, where I go into a little bit of a deep hole and then I come out for spring and then I'm totally into it in summer. We're going to Byron Bay over the break and it is like, you know, let's be honest, it's one of the most incredible parts of Australia and it's a privilege to go. So I'm very into it too. The other thing I like about summer, can I say, for me is And you don't get this in Queensland actually as much. So, you know, and I know you guys fiercely defend it, but I love daylight saving. Like
I love daylight saving.
I love it going dark later and having that part of that really, it's kind of a magical part of the evening where you can go. I go for walks in the evening. Yeah. I just love it.
You can have dinner later. Mind you, I also like a sunrise and it's pretty rugged trying to get up for sunrise at the moment. It's like 4:30 in the morning or something. So I am missing that.
But Fran, you did it for 17 years. It must be like a piece of, you know, that word.
Yes.
It must be very easy for you.
Well, I guess it must be easy. Or is it like a inbuilt trauma response? Oh, God, I'm not sure.
Oh, that's so good. I did breakfast for 3 years and I still get up, not quite the hideous hour we used to, but I still get up at 5. Like I get up pretty early, so I love it anyway. Look, Fran, over the summer, the other big question I have for you and actually for all our listeners too is, are you like a life be in it type? Are you kind of like the sort of kid that was in the nippers, you know, running on the beach, going nuts? Or are you a bit more cocktails and relaxing?
I'm definitely not a cocktails type. I am a life be in it type, that's for sure. But I've sort of got two speeds. I've got that speed. And then when I'm not at that speed, I like to be lying around. And I mean lying around. I'm really looking forward to reading some books because I've had so many books to read for the Radio National Hour for sort of, you know, work that I have to read. I just want to read some fiction. But I also am looking forward to reading Nikki Savva's Earthquake. Everyone else has probably read it by now and I haven't.
I've started it, I admit, but not ended.
But I've heard a lot of interviews with Nikki and it sounds amazing. And her books, I think, always deliver. So I am looking forward to that. But apart from that, it'll be, this is my filthy secret, thrillers.
You love thrillers.
I love crime novels.
I like that. And I like that about you. It says a lot about you too.
Yeah, it says a lot about me. Anyway, I'm looking forward to it.
I am currently compiling my summer reading list because I do always like, and I do that thing. I don't know if you do this, but like, yes, you can read the lists. You know, Readings puts one out, you know, The Guardian, The Sydney Morning Herald, you know.
Yeah,
the
ABC. I've got a lot of them.
Do that, right? But then I'm big on the friend recommends. Like if I've got a couple of mates that I think are very sharp, because I know which political books I'll always read. That's like done and dusted. That's in the pile. It always will happen because it's my go-to. But it's the fiction, like what is the most juicy fiction, and I'm currently like spreading the word on that.
Yeah, because you don't want to waste your time on a book that's not great, right?
No.
So I agree with you. I love a recommendation.
Yeah, so big on recommendations. So we're recording this in December, Fran, but we want to take a look at a few burning topics from our many excellent party rumours. And can I say, people be messaging me a lot, particularly after our show that we had in December that we did in Canberra. You'll remember that. And a few people, I just want to shout out about this because I've been meaning to tell you and I haven't had time to call you, so I'm just going to say it on the podcast. I've got messages from people who drove from Sydney for 3 hours. I know that drive well because I had a partner in Sydney and I did a lot of driving to interstate and then back to work. And I can tell you that they drove just for the party room life.
Isn't that fantastic? I love the party roomers. I love you all.
Now that's devotion. Like, of course we love you all equally. But if you're coming from like Woden or Braddon in Canberra to come, that's very special. I do appreciate you.
Tuesday night, fabulous.
But if you've hit the road for 3 hours, possibly booked yourself a hotel in Canberra if you're not driving straight home after, that to me is a gold star listener. Sorry, it is.
I agree. But PK, did they let you know whether it was worth it?
Yes. Yes, they said it was a great show, loved it, and then asked us, can we do one in Sydney? So we're working on it. I've just got a request actually I have to send to our producer Lara for one in Melbourne that some people would like us to do. So, yes, we're going to get around.
Let's go on a road trip.
Fran and Patricia on tour.
Great.
Look, on the agenda today, like there's a lot going on obviously, a lot of questions, a lot of disquiet I think still in the Liberal Party.
I think that's an understatement, PK. But
there's a lot of private conversations being had, Fran. They're kind of trying to keep it a bit on the down low, but not so successfully. Susan Lee and the glass cliff is one of the big topics of conversation. Why has Peter Dutton disappeared from the media? He's done this for a very good reason, I think. And have we ever seen other party leaders do this? And authenticity in politics, that's another one.
Yeah, that's a big one. Lots of fantastic questions. Thank you, all of you, for sending in your questions. We really, really appreciate it. Should we get on with it, PK?
Let's do it.
Questions without notice. Are there any questions?
Members on my right.
Prime Minister has the call.
Thanks very much, Mr. Speaker. Well,
then I give the call to the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister.
The bells are ringing. That means it's time for question time. And our first question comes from Dan.
Hi, Fran and PK. My question is, what will it take to actually get a ban on gambling advertising in this country? We also know that a majority of Australians support a ban on gambling advertising, and it is likely that a majority of parliamentarians do too. So any thoughts?
Well, that is a fantastic question, Dan. And you are not the only person, Dan, that cares about this. A lot of people care about it, particularly people, of course, who have had their lives ruined by gambling addiction. And that is a lot of families in this country, but also a lot of the Labor backbench. Increasing numbers of them who are frustrated that the government hasn't taken action on this. PM's addressed it a few times now. He's been questioned, for instance, by David Spears in December on it. Doesn't seem like they're overwhelmed with enthusiasm to do something.
Yeah, no, I think, in fact, the PM, I remember that interview on Insiders with David, the PM sounded less interested than I've sort of noted in the past. He's making the point that they've always made, which is, I think the phrase is something like, this government has done more on gambling reform than any other government. And they have done some things, but they haven't got close to implementing the Peter Murphy and that committee's recommendations, which is a total ban. And the word is that the Labor government is even contemplating stepping back a little from its original offer, which was an online gambling ad ban, and still sort of not going the whole hog on the TV ads. And now there's a suggestion that Labor's not going to do that either. So the PM, there's heavy lobbying going on here. The point of contention is that our mainstream media rely so heavily on gambling ads, and so do the sporting organisations. And, you know, we don't want our mainstream media organisations to fail. But there's got to be a middle ground here. The government needs to do something more on this, I think, because the polls are clear. Like, a huge majority of Australians want these ads banned. I love a phrase that I think it was Peter Dutton used once, which is, you know, footy time is family time, shouldn't have ads on it. I think a lot of people feel like that. And I think the government's under real pressure in this next year to do something. And as you say, PK, a lot of that pressure is coming from his own caucus room, his own backbench.
Yeah. And so far they've played nicely, Fran. That's the way they've operated. Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of, we've done a lot of podcasts about this, the power the Prime Minister has over these people, the way he's kind of delivered them so many seats. They feel very grateful. They know his political strategy and his instincts are often correct. But they will start agitating if they think that he's just not serious enough about some of the things that they're very passionate about that are symbolic of the kind of party they want to be and represent. And I think gambling's going to be one of them. I don't think, I know.
Well, they're going to have to do something more. And the question is, how far will they go? And I think the pressure will be on them because, you know, three-year terms means you've got to make policies and take them to the next election or it's become an issue. They're going to have to move fairly quickly, I think, in this next year to come up with something and then try and negotiate it through, you know. And the opposition, we've seen them play hardball on a few things. You know, now they're in December, they've been backtracking even on the under-16 social media ban, which was their idea. So I wouldn't expect the coalition to be a pushover on this.
No, I think that the coalition, to be very accurate, led on gambling. They did. They went first.
Yep.
Admittedly, not as far as the Peter Murphy review wants them to go. No. So, you know, but Labor's not even sort of agreeing to the Peter Dutton version of the reforms at this stage. So it's quite extraordinary how little action there's been. And they also led first on the social media ban too. So Peter Dutton got a few calls, right? There's a lot of critique of him, but you've got to look at some of the things where he did, I think, put sort of a stake in the ground on some issues, and they were definitely those issues. We've got another question now from, well, conveniently, the name is Peter.
Hi, PK, and welcome back, Fran. This is Peter from Manly in Sydney, New South Wales. My question is about a mystery. I can't remember a time in all my thinking about Australian politics where a prominent politician has disappeared from view, like Peter Dutton has subsequent to his loss at the last election. What is going on there? He literally has disappeared. I don't think he's been an interview or anything ever since. What are your thoughts?
So Peter has asked a question about Peter. I love that. A different Peter, of course. So Peter Dutton, why has he disappeared? Well, Peter Dutton made a decision, a very active decision, I know, because I've talked to him, that he doesn't want to be like Malcolm Turnbull. You know, like he doesn't want to be a commentator getting in the way. That's his view. Now, that doesn't mean, I don't know when you'll be listening to this, perhaps you'll even have broken some silence. I doubt it, by the way. But, you know, there's a chance. I don't want to time stamp us here, but he's definitely made a strategic decision to zip it, Fran.
I think it's funny that you say he doesn't want to be like Malcolm Turnbull, because it was Malcolm Turnbull, when he left the leadership, I think it was, I don't know, back in 2018 or something, who referred to Tony Abbott and Kevin Rudd as miserable ghosts. He said, I'm not going to be a miserable ghost like those two, you know, stalking, haunting the next PM and, you know, speaking out and fomenting unrest and criticising the new PM. And he said he wouldn't do that. So, you know, look, Peter Dutton is quiet for now. A lot of, Julia Gillard also disappeared. She disappeared and had made a decision that she was not going to be a commentator, I think is the phrase she used. And so it's not that it's that never happens. It does happen. There's a lot of pressure on former leaders to comment too, you know, particularly if they've been elders in their party.
Oh, like, we're calling them all the time.
Well, exactly right. Tony Abbott was under a lot of pressure. No one had to put pressure on Kevin Rudd so much. It was more like a voluntary kind of contribution. And Malcolm Turnbull, he resisted for a little while, but not for long. Peter Dutton, I would say too, is not, I wouldn't necessarily think, see if you agree with this, PK, he's not necessarily the book writing type. And a lot of them emerge once they've written their book. Then they feel like they've got out there and then they've cleared the air and then they sort of want to play a part.
I agree he's not the book writing type as a sort of general statement. However, this Nikki Savva book we mentioned at the start, it's absolutely, like, it really dumps a truck on Peter Dutton, right? Like, it does, and I'm not criticising for her for that because she's based it on many conversations and making a case. But, you know, it might spark him into some action. I mean, he might at some point want to defend his legacy, so to speak.
Well, he has done a little bit of that, but not on the public record, hasn't he? He's, you know, we know there's a few comments about his disappointment in some of his front bench, Andrew Hastie, for instance, and others. So he has not been entirely invisible, even though we haven't seen him. His voice has been out there. So, yes, right now.
Through proxies as well a few times.
It's probably a little hot to handle.
Yeah, I think that's right. Okay, our next question comes from Stephen.
Hey, guys, big fan of the pod. I've got three quick questions for you, with the first two being slightly connected. Firstly, Patricia often talks about the importance of authenticity in politics. So how important do you think it is right now, with the coalition's constant prevaricating regression on net zero and flailing around to find their people? Is this making authenticity the new political currency? To my second question, and connected, how much of One Nation's recent rise in popularity do you think comes from them appearing more authentic than the coalition, even if their positions are actually ridiculous and pretty disgusting? And finally, what do you think the broader electorate's tolerance is for politicians generally, and in this case, the coalition openly opposing environmental legislation they originally introduced under John Howard, essentially just to create a stick to whack the government with? Without sounding too Pollyanna-ish, at what point do voters start asking, what about what's actually best for the country, or did we see the answer to that at the last election? Thanks very much, guys. Have a good Christmas.
PK, Stephen said it right. You have big views on the authenticity in politics question.
I have big views about a lot of things.
Well, that's true.
But authenticity, yes. I really believe, which is what Stephen's picked up, so Stephen, thank you for picking up what I've put out, that there is nothing more important than authenticity in politics, in conviction, in being who you really are. And I don't think it's just politics. I think the most successful people are their full selves. It's become a bit of a cliche. I'm careful about using it, but that whole thing about bringing your full self to something, what that really means is that you're not pretending, because people are smart and they can pick a fake. And so if you believe in something and you really believe it and you researched and you know the stuff, you will be able to argue it more passionately. And so I think absolutely it's the most important thing in politics. Now, you ask about net zero and authenticity. Well, I think for the people who have fought hard against net zero and have won, the Conservatives, some of them, I actually think are very authentically against what they think is, you know, big internationalism, big kind of government trying to control everything and wanting to contest that way of running the kind of energy market. Now, I'm not backing it, to be clear, but I'm saying they really believe it. And there is a case to say that they might have, around the edges, some success because of how much they believe it, rather than ticking the box of signing up to net zero by 2050 and then never really arguing it, like never really believing in it, right? So in a weird way, there is a sort of authenticity around some of their views. I think of someone like Andrew Hastie, who first revealed on Decimated on Four Corners to me that he saw net zero like a straitjacket. You know, he really had an issue with the architecture around it. That's one thing. Back to One Nation. One Nation and Pauline Hanson's entire success model, whatever you think it's success, and it was at the last election, more Senate spots, her enduring role as the far-right politician in Australia, right, as our Nigel Farage, as our Trump in a kind of weird way, you know what I'm saying? Very different, but you know what I mean, is because of her authenticity. I'll give you one quote. I'm not going to tell you who, because they'll get upset with me in my life. Someone in my life said to me the other day, don't agree with Pauline, but you always know what she thinks. And I thought, bonza, like that is the line. And I think that matters in politics.
I think that does too. I think that's why Pauline Hanson, for instance, has endured in politics for, what is it, 23 years or something, some enormous length of time. But your convictions still need to be palatable to the Australian people, to the mass of Australian people. And some of her policies have been seen as a bit too wacky. I mean, I agree with you. Most of her support and her longevity is due to her authenticity. Some of it is also due to that sense in Australia amongst some of the electorate, which is, oh, look, at least she's having a crack at them. She's putting it right up them, you know. And, you know, the lack of trust and positive feelings towards our politicians means that also carries a dividend. But yeah, if we saw it, look, John Howard was an authentic politician. Paul Keating was an authentic politician. They said what they thought. They stuck to what they thought. They didn't really do anything off-brand much at all. And that counts. Whereas, you know, Kevin Rudd, when he was Prime Minister, he told us climate change was the great moral challenge of our time. And then when the Copenhagen Climate Conference went belly up and there was unpopularity, you know, Tony Abbott had pushed the whole thing about climate change. He backed off it. He dropped it. And that was seen as inauthentic. So I think authenticity, honouring your brand, it's important for people to know you are genuine. And that's why I think, for instance, with our current Prime Minister, who is, you know, brought up a lefty, young lefty, you might say, oh, some of these things he's doing, you know, they're not really true to his brand. But when he says things like, what I do is deliver on what I said. Listen to what I say, and that's what I'll do. And in a way, I think that's his authentic label. That is his authentic label, and he sticks to that. And I think that did pay some dividend. And certainly to your last point there, Stephen, about, you know, what point will voters actually ask what best for the country? I think that's what we saw in the last election. Not so much that Labor was authentic, but that they told us what they were going to do. They've done what they were going to do. They've since, again, acted on what they promised they'd do at the last election. They're managing, you know, relatively well the country, I suppose, whereas the opposition the last time around was a schmozzle, really. It was a shambles, that campaign of theirs. And people just thought, well, you're saying one thing, then you're backing off it, and we don't like that. We'll go for the bloke who's saying what he's doing and then doing it.
I think that's absolutely correct, Fran. We've got another question now, and this is from Paul.
Paul here from Yass. Love the show. I listen to it most days when I'm driving in and out of Canberra. In the last few years, we've heard a fair bit about the glass cliff where women such as Michelle Bullock from the RBA and Vanessa Hudson from Qantas have taken on very high risk senior roles within their organisations, but have done a really good job due to the support, you know, from those around them and their board. My question is, do you think Susan Ley was put in a glass cliff situation by the Liberal Party puppeteers, knowing that within 12 months or so, she was going to come up against an enormous issue such as net zero, and they would be able to install their more preferred male candidate? Thanks for thinking about my question, and I'll be listening.
Well, whether Susan Ley was put in to be because of the glass cliff, I'm not so sure, though I think there's a part of that. And often when you see after a large, large loss, you see a caretaker leader go in first, and that's a well-worn strategy. But I think Susan Ley was in there partly because the other two, or particularly Angus Taylor, who was up against her at that time, did not have a good election campaign, had a poor election campaign, was not seen to be a great performer in the year running up or on any of the shadow portfolios he'd had, actually. And so there was not a lot of kind of swell of support behind Angus necessarily as one who would deliver. I don't know there was a great deal of swell of support for Susan Ley either as a deliverer, but one thing we was written large in that election loss for the Liberals was they have a problem with women. Susan Ley is a woman. And I think they thought, well, that's going to be a good signal to us rebuilding. She's been around a long time. She's had a lot of front bench roles. You know, she's in that sense a steady set of hands. Not a huge deliverer, I think, of policy over her time. But I think it was more about that than the glass ceiling. But what do you think?
I think that's right, you know, but she was given sort of the hospital pass at the end, right? Like there's no doubt about it.
Yeah. And that's frequent. Like that happened to Joan Kerner in Victoria. It happened to Carmen Lawrence in WA, Anna Bligh in Queensland. Like it's not a new phenomenon.
No, it's not. And it's definitely what happens. And you're right about, you know, Vanessa Hudson. Like these are true.
Exactly. We're seeing it again now.
But I will say this. The Liberal Party maybe is doing something a little bit different, and they should be given some credit for it, in Melbourne, for instance, in Victoria, where they've elected Jess Wilson as their Liberal leader a year out from the election, a young woman in her first term, again, because they think she's the best chance they've got, so it's for their own interests. But I don't think for a glass ceiling reason. I think actually because finally they can see that she might be their best chance. So they've actually put her in at a time where if you look at the electoral cycle in Victoria, and people will agree with me if they're Victorians, even if they love Labor, they'll see that I'm right about the cycle, where there is a very good chance that if they do the right thing and they get it right, and there's a lot of ifs there, I know that, but that they could win that next election and unseat Labor from power. And she could actually not just get it at the end when she has to just fix it, but where she could actually build on something. So it's kind of just the other thing from the glass cliff. Maybe there's some shift for their own convenience because they need her. But do you know what I'm saying?
Well, sure. I mean, women politicians aren't just made leaders just because it's a hospital pass. Some of them are very, very good leaders. I think Joan Kernel was a good leader. I think Carmen Lawrence was a good leader. You know, it's not to say that they're less than, but they just stick them in to be the caretaker at midnight, overnight, or something like in the cricket. But, yeah, very often they don't get a look in until, you know, things are pretty dire.
Pretty dire. Okay. Our next question is from David, and he's written the question, and we can read. So I'm going to share with you, Fran. Firstly, welcome back, Fran. Yes, we've been welcoming back Fran for a while now. She's been back for a little while, but let's welcome her back again. In a cold, hard political reality, would it make sense for some women in the Liberal Party, either federal or state, to quit the Liberal Party and effectively join the Teals?
Well, it's an interesting question, and it's being asked a lot at the moment. I think that most of the women in the Liberal Party would not want to leave the Liberal Party because many of them have been members for a while. They're committed to the party. They think we live in a two-party system. They want to be a part of a member of a party of government. They don't want to be an independent. They want to have a stepping stone of career and ambition, and they want to be there in the end making decisions. However, the flip side of that is one of the big problems for the Liberal Party, of course, is they don't have enough women. They're not attracting good, strong women candidates. And they're not, and a significant number, I think, of the Teals are women who in the past who may have been attracted to the Liberal Party, who may have been recruited to the Liberal Party. And so they've lost, in a sense, a pool of talent to these independents, community independents, Teal independents, whatever you want to call them. And they're finding it hard to recruit good challengers, good candidates. So it's a problem for the Liberal Party, but I don't think that many of the women in the Liberal Party think it would make sense for them to go to the crossbench.
I think that's absolutely correct. I think they, you know, we've said this before, they actually believe in the Liberal Party.
Yeah, they believe in
a party of government as it's sort of considered. Although I think our politics is changing. Just broadly on the Teals though, I just want to get this kind of thought in. I really want to been wanting to say this somewhere. It wasn't even in the question.
Let's have it. People
come here for new things. I've been speaking to some senior Labor people, and a few of them have put this to me. They say, if you look at the electoral map, and then I did, there's not a lot of more work that the Teals as a movement have to do to get rid of Liberals, because they've kind of done a lot of that damage now. You know, it's pretty hard for them to win, maybe in some country seats, the sort of Cathy McGowan model, maybe. But in terms of the metropolitans, they're decimated. They're done, right? Like, they've really had such a big impact. So where do they need to move next? It kind of is in Labor city territory, right? So in the places, I'm not, you know, somewhere like Josh Burns's seat. Now, he's a very strong MP, so maybe it wouldn't work there. But you know what I'm saying? Like, places.
Pretty tight seat,
yeah,
though.
Places where they can appeal and say, like we said before, I think the gambling example is a good one. Oh, they haven't done much on gambling. These guys are weak. You know, you need us. You need these sorts of candidates to do well. So I can see the Teal movement, if they get their order in shape, as being a real challenge to Labor at the next election if Labor drags the chain on some of these more progressive ideas.
Well, that would be interesting, wouldn't it? Because Labor's already squeezed on the left in a lot of those seats, the sort of seats you're talking about there, by the Greens. So they've already had their grass cut a bit by the Greens on the left. If they then have a sort of a progressive but less progressive or economically conservative sort of candidates coming at them on the other flank, they could be under real pressure. It is interesting, isn't it? A lot of mayors of councils are female, quite a lot. And that gives an indication that, you know, the community will swing in behind a female candidate because they're so very often deeply connected into the community. And that's the button that the Cathy McGowans pushed, that sort of thing. So I think we could see some more Teals in country seats, like you've suggested, for that very reason. But, yeah, I'm not sure how worried Labor is about this.
I think they are worried and they are alive to it, but whether they address it is a whole different issue. Our next question comes from Paul.
Hey, party people. Paul from Canberra here. Just listening to your update about the moderates in the Liberal Party and Susan Leith speaking for them, because apparently they can't speak for themselves. Meanwhile, the Conservatives are out there speaking for themselves quite loudly. And I'm wondering, why don't the moderates in the Liberal Party simply go independent? Is it tougher than they think being a Teal, or is the Murdoch media too good at tearing them down? Thanks in advance. Bye.
I think that question about getting torn down is an interesting one, about a bit of a fear. Yes, I do think there is a bit of a concerted campaign around Teals being fakes and all of this. I'm sure it does run through the minds of people wanting to run, don't you think, Fran?
Oh, I do. And it's not just the Murdoch media doing it. It's also people within the Liberal Party doing it and the coalition more generally. So, you know, if
you
were...
To be fair, dirt runs both ways, though. I don't think the Teals are, like, you know, afraid of going hard against the Libs.
No, no, they do go hard, but...
They do. There's a sort of, they do. They all go hard.
I think there's a flavour to the tone because, let's face it, they stole their heartland. They've stolen their heartland. So the antipathy is deeply entrenched. And the moderates know that, and I don't think they're going to join them. Anyway, it's the moderates they've been knocking off, the Teals, so I don't think they're going to join them for that reason either. And also, I think it is tougher being an independent.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And for all those reasons we said before, if you've got ambition, you want to be a part of the leadership of the country at some point, you want to be a part of the party of government, you're not going to go independent.
No. Yeah, I think that's all very correct.
All very correct. I love that.
I've had a lot of fun, Fran, answering people's questions, yeah, getting to hang out with you, getting to talk about politics, talking about my time in the surf. Keep sending your questions in because we hear them, we like getting them, we like answering them too. It's kind of like challenges us too to think about things differently that we haven't been considering. You can send those to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
Yeah, it is great. And it is fantastic to get the chance to field some more of them because we get them through the weeks and we just can't fit them into the podcast record. So this is a great chance. It shows you're really listening and thinking and we appreciate it. Remember, you can follow Politics Now. That's the feed where you get this podcast, the Party Room podcast, on the ABC Listen app. So you never miss an episode.
See you, Fran.
See you, PK.